a poem called What the Doctor Said by Raymond Carver. He said it doesn't look good. He said it looks bad, in fact, real bad. He said I counted 32 of them on one lung before I quit counting them. I said, I'm glad I wouldn't want to know about any more being there than that. He said, are you a religious man? Do you kneel down in forest groves and let yourself ask for help when you come to a waterfall, mist blowing against your face and arms? Do you stop and ask for understanding at those moments? I said, not yet, but I intend to start today. He said, I'm real sorry, he said. I wish I had some other kind of news to give you. I said, amen. And he said something else I didn't catch, and not knowing what else to do, and not wanting him to have to repeat it, and me having to fully digest it. I just looked at him for a minute, and he looked back. And it was then I jumped up and shook hands with this man who'd just given me something no one else on earth had ever given me. I may have even thanked him, the habit being so strong. What the Doctor Said by Raymond Carver. So I wanted to read that poem in relationship to wise livelihood, because sometimes we think, you know, livelihood has to be this big grandiose thing that's really, you know, releasing suffering for all beings everywhere, that we have to be somehow these living Buddhas. But sometimes it's simply being kind, this willingness to connect in the mundane and also the very difficult. And this is what I want to touch upon, that kind of regardless of whatever work we do, whether we have a job or if we work out of home or we care for others, care for children or for elderly or don't work at all. Maybe we're retired or can't work for other reasons. Just how do we use our time? How do we interact with people? How do we use that as a spiritual practice? Because I was reflecting as we were sitting together in Sangha, that, you know, the practice seems so internal, so quiet, so in some ways just your own practice. And yet, we come off practice, how we live in the world, how we actually show up in the world really matters. And I love that the Buddha made this very explicitly true in the fundamental teachings of the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. The whole middle section is how do we act in the world? How do we actually show up? How do we speak matters? How do we act matters? How we make a living matters? All these are essential to not only integrating our practice, but also really demonstrating it, if you will. Living it, walking the talk, as they say. And sometimes we feel like, okay, my life, my work is just so mundane. It doesn't feel very spiritual. It doesn't feel like it's doing anything to heal the planet or to heal all the sorrows in the world. But imagine that if you, every day you went to work, that you met everyone you talked to and everyone you interacted with, your customers, your fellow coworkers, your supervisors and bosses, with a level of kindness, of respect, of care. And if everyone did that, how that would have this profound effect in the world. And I think we've all had this experience of, you know, you feel pretty good and you interact with someone who's having a really bad day and they kind of take it out on you a little bit. And then you kind of carry it like a virus to the next person. You're a little bit more cranky to them. And then there's some of this level of crankiness just kind of spreads all over the place. And the same thing happens when you have a level of kindness, of connection, when you choose to connect, when you choose to actually be connected to another person, to actually listen, to actually come from a place of the heart, that also spreads, because that then you're more likely to give that to the next person and so on. So in this way, this is a very it seems very simple and easy to overlook and minimize, but I think it's actually very profound, is how we are in these simple ways. Because we can all kind of gear up when we have to. Okay, I'm going to practice and be really spiritual. But how we are just the day to day, just the moment by moment. And so I want to offer five words. And these aren't usual words we think of in terms of the Dharma lists and all the teachings of Buddha, yet they help us kind of orient ourselves in a particular way. And the first one is to simply be kind, to be kind in our interactions with others and also with ourselves. I'd like to, you know, bring that into the forefront too, is how we are with our own internal dialogue, our own internal relationship also matters. Because we can be very outwardly kind, but be just this huge, raging internal critic, you know, that there's a discrepancy, there's a dissonance, there's a lack of integrity around that. And so with all these, as I talk about them, caring for oneself also, having that sense of compassion when we're worn out, when we are cranky, or maybe we're exhausted, maybe we're overwhelmed by some life experience or situation. You know, how can we bring wisdom, compassion, clear comprehension to that? And sometimes it's just realizing, okay, I need to be a little bit slower in how I interact. I need to pause a little bit more before I ask or before I say something. I was watching a comedian who was telling a joke, but he asked his father, how did he stay married for so long? And his father said, don't say the first or second thing that comes to your mind. Say the third thing. You know, to pause with it. Because often the first thing you say that, you're going to get divorced. Second thing, you're going to be on the couch. But the third thing, then you're going to have a happy relationship. You know, because you pause. You're going to let that wisdom come forth. And I thought that was good advice. And that's one of the secrets with kindness, is that sometimes that's not our initial tendency, right? Maybe we're feeling defensive or hurt or judged. Maybe we're really under-resourced. We're so exhausted. It's so easy just to snap. Pause a little bit. Just take a few moments. Notice the initial impulse. Notice the second impulse. And then go forth. This is something we teach in an intro class and on retreats, is when we're practicing in meditation for a sustained amount of time, you know, why not just scratch an itch, for example? Why not just adjust the body? Why sit still? And it's actually really helpful to practice sitting in the midst of that impulse to scratch or to do something, right? Maybe three times, and the third time, then you can consciously scratch. But usually we're just kind of scratching without even realizing we're doing it. We're trying to alleviate that little bit of suffering, that little bit of discomfort. But practicing, stretching our capacity to hold the discomfort helps us stretch this capacity to be kind, to not come up from a place of harshness or harm. Okay, let me have a sense of holding my own experience, holding my own pain. Because there is so much pain in the world. I mean, sometimes just reflect upon how much suffering there is. You know, a complete stranger or those that you know and love, you hear about some horrible thing on the news. And just reflect on how much pain has been caused and how much suffering is there. It's hard being human, right? It's hard having a human body that gets old, gets injured, loses its capacity. It's hard having a human heart that would be heartbroken time in and time again. So a quality of compassion, of kindness. The next word I came to me was being respectful. Being respectful. So when we're working, we're being around other people, having a sense of seeing their wholeness, their integrity, and your own wholeness too. So you're also respectful of your own limits, your own capacity. And this sense of respect is interesting, because often we do kind of look down on people, or maybe we think they're not as good, or maybe they're slower. But to have that sense of respect, again, we kind of train that in this almost behind the scenes way with our meditation practice. How we started off today, just acknowledging how this mind and body is. And for years, I would start to practice, and I thought I had to get someplace. I had to get to a certain state of mind, a certain quality of calmness and quiet. And yet, I would kind of ignore or deny or repress how my mind and body was in that moment. And I learned that often, you know, through time, that actually sitting down for a few moments and just acknowledging, oh, the body is tired, or the body is anxious, or the mind is really fragile or fragmented, to acknowledge that, to be okay with that, to create space for it. That's one way to frame it, is that meditation creates space for how this experience is. Doesn't mean we may not need to do something about it or try to help it or alleviate it, but creating that sense of space. And so respect is like that too. And how that shows up in the small ways. You know, like when you're in a grocery line, you know, do you maybe let someone else go ahead of you? Or do you kind of push forward? You know, I go shopping at Costco, and it's interesting what a social experiment it is, because sometimes you got the professional shoppers who are like just zipping through everything, and then you got the people who are kind of like, oh wow, look at that, and look at this, and then there's me with maybe I have to hurry up and get something, but can I take a pause? Can I realize that just because I'm behind schedule doesn't mean everyone else has to conform to that, has to change to fit me? You know, so this is that sense of being respectful, respectful of other people. And in the work environment or however we define livelihood, this is such a helpful thing. You know, we're caring for children, having that sense of respect. Of how I love when I see young kids to just try to get down and connect with them just where they are. How are they? If they're shy, if they're outgoing, if they're saying something that's really fanciful, can I connect with where they are? Can actually see them as a human being at whatever stage of development they are. The next one is to be clear. To be clear. So clear comprehension is a word we often throw out, and we can also think of Dharma as often this movement through delusion, clearing delusion. So there's clear comprehension, clarity of seeing things, how they actually are. And so when we're clear inside, we're also noticing when we're not clear is probably even more important. Because when we're not clear, sometimes for myself, sometimes my mind feels a little foggy, or I just feel like things aren't quite all lined up or stacked up, if that makes sense. It's like I can know, it's like I'm just undivided about it. Divided about what I think is right or the right choice it is. Like I was working on a guiding teacher issue this morning with another guiding teacher, and just feeling that, trying to figure out the course of action and respecting the lack of clarity. It's like, I'm not sure what the right course is. I'm not sure what's the right solution here. And being willing to pause with that, to wait for the clarity to come forth. It's like that analogy of a glass of water with mud in it. If we allow it to settle, we start to have that quality of clarity. And so sometimes that settling allows you to, your subconscious to work. Sometimes meditation helps you to notice what's not being seen. That's often what I think is when we're struggling with some lack of clarity, there's something that's not being seen about our relationship to this moment or this situation. Maybe there's something that we're hooked by that we don't realize it. And when I finally touch into that, when I see it and open to it, then clarity happens. And then the pathway opens up. So having this intention to try to be as clear as I can and to know when I'm not clear. You know, so if someone gives you instructions to do a job and you're not quite sure what to do. I mean, when I was younger, I would just say, okay, even though if I had no idea what I was actually supposed to do. And now I've learned to say, I don't quite understand that. Let's clarify that. Let me understand more fully what exactly I need to do. And of course, clarity also includes all the times we feel hooked, if you will, or kind of charged or triggered by someone. Just realize, okay, there's that triggeredness. And is there a pathway to get clear? Is there a pathway to acknowledge what was said or my actions or their actions? And a lot of it is seeing my own deeper kind of belief around it. When there's that seeing, then clarity arises. The next one is to be honest, to simply be honest in our dealings, our interactions, and in our how we are in the world. So that honesty, I know sometimes our jobs, we have to be a certain way. Maybe there's a projection we have to put on or a way we have to present ourselves. And yet we can still have some level of honesty underneath that. And ideally, we can be completely honest or just more in sense of integrity. I remember one of my therapists once said, it's okay to look how you feel. It's okay to look how you feel. You know, and often our society says you're not supposed to look how you feel. You know, we have all this cultural conditioning. I don't know if Cuba's on the line, but she shared this quote by Robert Bly, I think, that's something like we carry this trail of baggage, basically our cultural baggage, like we're just trailing it behind us, how we've been conditioned to be. You know, you're supposed to be this emotion, but not this emotion. So learning to feel that. And sometimes it can be very subtle. I love playing with interactions with people you usually would not really pay much attention to. Checkout people, people on the grocery line, people who are in the service industry, to actually connect with them, to actually see who they are in that moment, to hear, you know, say how long is your day going, how much more time. If you ask sincerely, they often come forth with that. They often share that. And there's that moment of connection, moment of being real. Now, honesty is one of those words that we could certainly use more of this day and age. There's this very vivid sutta from the Buddha's time when he was talking to his son, actually, who ordained and was, I don't know, 6 or 7 or 8 or something, and apparently told a lie. And the Buddha, they were washing their feet, and the Buddha held up the water bowl and said, okay, look how much water is left in this. Okay, after we wash your feet, not very much. That's how much is left of your integrity if you tell a deliberate lie. And look, I've dumped it out. That's how much of your spiritual growth is left. And he just kept emphasizing the emptiness of that. And finally, he said that someone who's willing to tell a deliberate lie, there's nothing they're not capable of doing. And I'll let you extrapolate from there on that one if you want. But that sense of honesty around yourself, you know, how can I be honest with my words, with my actions? And the final one is to be sincere. You know, sincere is this kind of full-heartedness that we bring forth. You know, can I be full-hearted, fully present, fully connected to this work I'm doing, this interaction? Sometimes we need to reflect back why we got into this field of work in the first place. You know, maybe there's some passion that has been kind of diminished and lost over time. Maybe we can rekindle that. Maybe there's a sense of, you know, we just needed to kind of get by and be able to survive. Okay, so having that thankfulness that I actually am able to make a living. Or just the joy of being with kids or being with caring for someone. How can we rekindle that and bring a quality of wholeheartedness, a sense of I'm showing up all the way. You know, how often we stay a little divided. Maybe our mind's kind of thinking about something else. Can we bring whole attention to bear, our whole self to bear? So I hope these words of and way of thinking out of kindness, being respectful, being clear, being honest, being sincere, just a way of fleshing out this wise livelihood. Because we spend so much of our time making a living in this world, to bring it into our spiritual practice, into our Dharma life, is so enriching and so beneficial. It really helps us deepen into our practice. All right, let's just sit quietly for a moment or two, and then I'll give a couple of announcements. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break. We'll come back, and then we'll have a chance for some small group discussion around this important topic of livelihood. All right, see you in 5 minutes. Okay, welcome back. right, welcome back. And so, Jackie, in a minute, we'll have some breakout rooms. Probably 4 to 5 people is a good number. So let's just frame the breakout rooms. So these are a chance for you to talk about your practice. It's really a rare opportunity to be able to say, you know, what am I noticing? How am I integrating my Dharma practice into my life, into my livelihood? And these groups are really about practicing sharing as deeply as you can, as honestly as you can. And it's also a practice of other people listening, right? So it's not about trying to solve or offer suggestions. Even if you have the perfect suggestion, kind of keep the content of the room or the group itself just about listening and receiving that, right? Afterwards, you could ask the person, hey, I had an idea. You know, you can ask permission to share it. But it's more respectful not to launch into all your helpful ideas, which sometimes it's just nice to be heard, just be received. So I'd like us to just talk about wise livelihood and the general topic. You know, how did that land for you working on it this month? If you were here the whole month or just coming in tonight, what's the sense of wise livelihood for you? Do you feel like you're able to express that? Are you able to embody it? Are there places which are difficult around it? And just kind of talk more generally about it. Is that enough guidance to go on? Okay. All right. So in the room, what you find, ideally, it's like 4 people. So it's a group of 4 to 5 people is a nice number. And online, we can do the same. We'll do this for about 20 minutes. So I'll give us a 5-minute warning as we come back. Okay, welcome back. So we have a space now for any sharing you might have around this topic of livelihood or about Dharma in general. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to respond to those. Right? So again, online, you can just raise your virtual hand. In person, raise your physical hand, and we'll bring the mic around so we can hear you online.
Thanks. Okay. So I guess one insight I had was just that our minds have habituated ways of imagining someone else's experience or what led them to certain behavior. And we've gotten that through our socialization and our experiences. And there may be a reason that we can't even imagine for what's causing a behavior. And so being respectful of that mystery or that blind spot is necessary to have the space to really respect or empathize with someone. And so the example that I was giving was like the hormonal changes that happen around menopause and how many women, like, as a child, you might not understand what your mother's going through. Even as you get to that age, you might not quite understand what's directing your own behavior or your friend group's behavior. And then also, if you're a man, it may be really outside of your experience, and you might not understand it as well.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, to give people space, benefit of the doubt, that we just don't know what is going on with that. I remember I had a friend when I did Aikido for a number of years. He had a new baby, and he would go to training early and then just take a nap in the car. And we would sometimes, he would oversleep and would come up and bug him and tease him about it. And then a few years later, I had a newborn, and I realized, wow, I'm so tired. And I asked him, why didn't you just tell us you were really tired? And he said, you wouldn't have understood until you actually go through that. And that's how it is. And so just realize we may understand more in the future, but you know, to hold that, especially with people, we don't have a chance to really unpack what's going on with them, create that sense of space. But we can still be kind. We can still be connected. We can still have that sense of respect. Yeah, very important. All right. What else is out there?
Hi. Hi there. Our group talked about corporate culture and other kinds of work cultures mm-hmm. that are intense, competitive, and, you know, maybe not as kind as as we'd like, you know, as far as how people treat each other in those kind of environments. And I think we had a nice discussion just about it's challenging to practice these things of, you know, pause or even be kind or respectful. I mean, I think when people are under stress, mm-hmm. you know, then that's when behavior comes out that's maybe not so nice. But I think that just that struggle, that challenge of being in those environments that have that kind of culture, and this is a counterculture, what we're talking about. Yeah. And so that's not easy.
No, it's not. Yes. Yeah. The Buddha talked about following the Dharma is like going upstream, because the stream's going the other direction. And if everyone around you is going a certain way, it does take a certain, you know, courage, or it's often encouraged just to be, you know, a little different, to actually maybe go a different way. And sometimes that's not rewarded, right? Especially if the corporate culture is such that it's, you know, that kind of behavior, that behavior is not rewarded. It's like you have to make those little choices. And, you know, I'm thinking of Viktor Frankl's A Man's Search for Meaning. And he, you know, talked about being in the concentration camps, you know, and that's a pretty toxic mm-hmm. culture right there. Mm-hmm. But how does he find meaning in the midst of that? Mm-hmm. How do you find a sense of what's really important to you? So that's, I think it's possible. You know, sure. It's certainly some environments are more easy. By the way, you can say that, look at it as if it's really challenging, the lessons are actually more deeply learned. Can I learn this even in the midst of this situation?
Right.
And it might look, you know, very almost covertly that you're just kind of pausing for a little bit. You're feeling the body. Maybe pausing might look like keeping 10 or 20% of your awareness in your body while you're doing your work and talking. I can feel my feet while I'm talking. Mm-hmm. And that in itself gives you a little bit of that pause. It's not like, okay, let's just all take a minute here and breathe together. You know,
that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Keep a little bit of that awareness in the body. Everybody got wise livelihood down, it looks like.
I'll add something. In our group, one person mentioned how a lot of the people talked about their difficulties at work. And I retired in 2013, and I've had difficulties as a volunteer, but I had real difficulties at work, right? It was horrible. I hated going to work. I didn't want to go to work. I was always trying to look for different ways to make money. And so it was always like this. Anyway, I thought that was interesting. Now I don't hate work like that anymore. so I don't have that going on. So it's also, you know, impermanence. There's impermanence there.
Yeah, it's like that. Yeah, sometimes the situation is just so difficult. It's hostile. It's, you know, abusive. All those kind of qualities. And how do we keep going? How kind of are stuck in that environment? And yet, yeah, things do change. And yeah, sometimes just letting it go. I had a friend who talked about his coworker who always went to work with his resignation letter in his lunchbox. So he was always ready. If this was the last day, okay. So. All right, what else is out there?
I was just reflecting when you said that often our experiences with right livelihood are like our livelihood is rough, and we're navigating that. And something I've been reflecting on the past couple of weeks is starting a small business and figuring out what that looks like. Mm-hmm. And it's actually been really interesting to be practicing with it and realize that for a long time, I was in environments where it didn't feel great. And there was a little bit of a disconnect between like comfort and reality. And it actually has taken a lot of work and like literally meditating on it to tap into what are my needs? What are my boundaries at work? What does comfort look like? What does a supportive situation look like logistically, interpersonally, like spatially? And your talk made me think of it when you were sharing kind of the clarity that can come with sitting with these questions. And I have been getting some clarity, and when it's there, it's so clear. Mm. But I was also just appreciating what you said, because I'm sure that in a week, impermanence is very real. I'm sure a lot of it will be gone. But yeah, I think on the other side of the coin, it's just been really interesting to disentangle, like, what it actually, I think, takes a lot of work to register. What does a peaceful work environment look like? What does a safe work environment look like? And how personal and nuanced that is, and often different from like the norm or what you think it might be.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I think we often have more options than we may realize. You know, and sometimes it's like the door is the right way out. And sometimes having that courage to start your own business, and all, you know, how do I structure that? And it's a learning process, right? And we get it perfect, and then we get a new manager, or the situation changes, and it goes out the door, and then we learn to manage that. Yeah, go ahead, Leslie. I'll get one online. Okay, can we come back to you, Leslie? Go ahead, Karen.
This couple of weeks have been a great talk, because I've had 12 weeks off and I have to go back to work this week, and I'm not looking forward to it. And I made a comment to a friend that, and then last year I had actually a 4-month break from my job, and that I feel like a different person when I'm not at work, and that like, I'm afraid I'm going to be the person I'm becoming. In the pressure cooker, time-oriented job that I do. And I really appreciate you saying, like, when you said, well, let's all just take a moment to breathe here, like, not going to happen. So I really appreciate you saying, well, where are my feet? Because in my mind, I'll be able to do that. But in the time, kind of, you know, and there's just shortening the time of our work. So it's just going to be picking this pace up. I'm like, I have this dread of this work that I've been really working on hard over these 12 weeks of just breathing and sitting and reflecting. And I can't right now leave my job or find something else. But I found out that I do really like my job, and I do like a lot of my coworkers. And I would like to know some of these people outside the arena, because I think I would like them. But the corporate or whatever, you know, world is about money, and how can I bring those two together? And it's just been this process, and especially since the time is coming to an end. But I so appreciate you saying that it doesn't have to be where everybody takes a minute to come to the body, just even for a second is just important. Maybe can make the difference in pressure cooker world. So,
yes. Yeah, I think that sometimes we get caught in the form of meditation, and we think how it should look. You know, the classic is you go on a meditation retreat and you don't have any work to do except a yogi job. And then you try to duplicate that when you go home, and it just doesn't work. But if you can have just that little, how I can make it just a little bit of connection to this present moment, just a little bit, like 10% of my body, 5% of feeling my body as I'm talking, as I'm walking. I go to the bathroom and I use that time to really feel my feet touching the ground. those kind of little windows start to create this little bit of space. And that is like when we don't feel like we have any space, that's when we feel really trapped and overwhelmed. But a little bit of space, just taking a moment to ask someone, you know, how are you doing? You know, how was the game last night? How are you kids doing? In a way that actually builds that sense of connection. And so it's challenging. It's challenging in many jobs, and some jobs it seems impossible. And yet we can just, what is possible? You know, what's that little bit of connection? So wish you well in that, Karen, going back to the world of work. Yeah, Leslie.
I just have been reflecting on Right Livelihood in terms of, I've been retired for a while now, but my thoughts about my job have been, I did a terrible job, I did, you know, and reflecting on it now, it's like, I was in the public sector working with challenging situations with people who really needed support, and I didn't do that bad a job, you know, but at the time, because of the constraints of the job and what was expected, things that I was supposed to do that I was never very good at and could never figure out how to do, really, I just kind of did different things. And so I was always judging myself about how poorly I did in my job based on those external constraints, rather than how I interacted with the people that I worked with, and just realizing that I did that pretty well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's been really nice. It's really freeing in many ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so now I'm retired, which is hallelujah. But anyway, so I just wanted to share that. Thanks.
So if you could go back in time, would you tell that younger self to reflect on the good that you're doing?
If I could go back in time, I would be practicing. That would have been a lot of help. I mean, I was meditating, but not in this particular arena. But I mean, and honestly, getting to mindfulness and meditation happened because of that job. So yeah, that's been really a gift.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all good.
I think that's also, you know, a good suggestion. If we have a job that's difficult, feel like we're not doing so well at, you know, maybe consciously cultivate, you know, just reflect before you go to bed what you did well that day. You know, just a show of hands. Anyone in the room feel like they have too much self-esteem and feel too good about themselves? You know, I think we kind of got that part down pretty well. So practice, you know, just like, wow, you look like Leslie was saying, is like, I may have failed all these other things, but you have to kind of counteract that negativity bias. You all know that term is like, we are evolutionarily designed to pay attention to what's wrong, because that helped our ancestors survive. So we kind of, our nervous system's highlighted for that. But to actually cultivate, okay, well, I did that interaction really well. I really connected with that person. Maybe it's not what I'm paid to do, or maybe I'm supposed to do, but yet I connect it, you know, and that starts to brighten the mind, starts to change the whole dynamic. Because if you focus on what's not working well, you know, we're going to get more and more stressed. All right, maybe one or two more if there's anyone.
Tim, I just wanted to thank you for the framing you've done a couple of times about Right Livelihood being just how we use our time.
Yes.
And breaking it bigger than the work piece or the caregiving piece or whatever it is. You know, that it's everything. And you've talked over the year in different ways about these sort of small moments, the cash register moment or the getting on the bus moment. And it's been seeping into me, and I've just do it more, and it's just it's so infinite. There's endless opportunity. It gives me energy. I feel like a positive energy exchange happens even if you just look somebody in the eye and smile, like wherever you are. But there's no quantity to it. Like, it's not bound. It's super cool. I just wanted to thank you for emphasizing it, because it's been a really nice addition to my life.
Yeah, so, thank you for sharing that. yeah, it does bring energy, and it does just transform a day. Because we get in a funk and we're just kind of, our eyes go down. We don't want to talk to anybody, but actually to make contact, then there's this sense of joy, simple joy, simply of connection.
And yeah, you actually made me realize something I need to practice, which is I have a favorite person I see who sells real change. Mm-hmm. And I now, I'm admitting to myself, this really feels like right livelihood. Like if I'm in a funk, I park where I'm not going to see him, and I go in the back door, and I feel like annoyed with myself. I'm like, I always have a good time talking to him. All he ever does is smile at me. All I ever do is smile at him. But why is this, like, some days I'm too low or guarded to have the positive experience? Mm. And then I sort of feel like crap. I mean, I was going to say a different word, but anyway. But I think that's really fun for me to think about, of like, to go say hi to him when I don't feel like saying hi. And like, what do I think I'm losing by giving up my grumpiness? You know what I mean?
That's anyway. Right. Yeah, that's a good reflection. Yeah, sometimes it's that we do get attached to the grumpiness. Right? But also we can start to see, meditation starts to open up those choice points. We can see, oh, you know, it's, I'm avoiding this interaction, and what's going on with that. And just pausing with it a little bit starts to give you a chance to, okay, maybe I will go the way I don't want to go right now and see what happens.
Yeah, thanks for that.
All right, we're just going to keep going. All right, anyone else? Yes, Ronnie.
Thank you. I have a question about deliberately changing a mind state. Mm-hmm. Whether that's a form of judgment in and of itself, even if it's a negative mind state, if we deliberately change it, I'm kind of struggling with.
Sure. Yeah, so the deliberately changing a mind state, is that a sense of avoidance, or is it a sense of what was the word you asked? Was it?
I forget the word I used.
Yeah, I forget. Judgment. Yeah, there was that word. Thank you. Judgment. Well, and that's this interesting territory of discernment versus judgment. And a lot of it is kind of the habit, or how conscious we are of it. I think that's the big piece. So if we're kind of habitually always changing our mind state, because I don't want to be in this one mind state. I want to keep switching it, and I'm not able to hold open to it. Then that's, you know, that there's kind of that movement away. There's a movement away from that experience. But at the same time, there can be this wisdom. It's like, how much do I really need to stay in the middle of this irritated mood, or this angry mood, or this depressed mood? Once I've kind of opened to it, and there's not a sense of charge with it, feeling it, then it can be just this conscious choice that, okay, I don't want to, it's not really healthy or helpful to be in that and to be able to switch that. And that's often what we, I think people who are really adept socially are able to do that. They're able to connect with someone, connect where they are, and then able to maybe help shift it to a different energy, if that makes sense.
What do you mean, switch into a different energy?
Well, have you ever seen, what was that movie? Is it Shall We? No, it wasn't Shall We Dance. It was one of those dance movies. But there's this owner of the dance studio who would be having a hard time, and she said, okay, put on your happy face and just kind of go into that, you know, really overt smiley face, even though that's what she wasn't feeling. She was really denying what was her experience was. So that's different than connecting with what the experience is, and then choosing to shift it. Can I connect with it fully and then choose, okay, this isn't so helpful? But a lot of it is you just start to notice the pattern, right? Like if I'm always shifting, that becomes more of this avoidance. But if I've opened to it, I feel it fully, and it's more of a choice if it's just more healthy to go through. Does that help a little bit, or no, I just kind of said the same thing over again? I hope it made more sense. Go ahead.
So basically, it's wisdom.
Yes, wisdom.
As opposed to avoidance.
Yeah, that's one way to think of it. Yeah, is it avoidance or is it wisdom? Yeah. How much choice do you have in that?
And what you're saying by choice is choice and wisdom is you're sort of equating the two.
Yes. Yeah. The more, say, the more wisdom we have, the more clearly we see things, the more clearly we see this path leads to, like with your example, you know, staying in the grumpiness. This path leads to confronting someone who smiles at me and making me smile and shift out of the mode. You can see it clearly, and you can see start to see the intention and the motivation, the clinging to one versus the other. So we can't always go by how it feels to, because often the sense of this may not feel good to do that, but we may know what it's more beneficial to do that. You're welcome. All right, so thank you all. So next week, as I mentioned, Tuari Salal will be here teaching for 2 weeks. Wise Effort, another rich fold of the Eightfold Path. All right, so I wish you all well, and we'll see you next time.